When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, welcome to CarCast. I'm Matt, the moderator, DeAndrea, and here with our guest, Tanner Faust. So, how are you, Tanner?
I am great, Matt. It's good to talk to you. It's been a little while,
and we've got, I don't know, just crazy weather going on over here. It's just raining, and it just doesn't seem to stop. We get like 2 days of sunshine, and then it starts all over again, and California's not equipped for this much rain.
No. You know? The worry is that it doesn't, you know, there's been a problem for a long time, you know, with reservoirs being low. And if you ever go to Lake Powell or ever go to any of the reservoirs, Big Bear even, you know, it's record lows, right?
Yeah.
And you hope that going through a season like this completely fixes that. But it's almost like too much all at once. It just washes out into the ocean and doesn't get captured.
We can't collect it all. Yeah, we can't do it.
But I was in Mammoth got back yesterday. And I mean, I'll show you some videos here in a little bit, but it's like the people that have paid the, by the way, like 5-10x normal price for snow plowing, that can get to their houses.
Yeah.
It's just a tunnel to the garage. And the people that decided, you know what, they're just getting reamed by these snow plow guys that wouldn't do it. They've shoveled themselves. They've literally made like a walking cave to get to the door, and they can't get their car there, obviously. But the houses are buried and they're under two stories of snow. It's impossible to really describe.
Yeah. So we do the other podcast, Shift and Steer, with Aaron Hagar. He lives in Lake Tahoe.
And, oh gosh, yeah.
And every week we're going on the podcast, there's a conversation of just like the snow that's out there, and he keeps trying to clear a path, and you kind of have to do it every day. And then he does the house, and he goes over to the shop, and his shop isn't big enough to put all of his cars in. So he's got a few things out. Like he's got like three Isettas, like BMW Isettas, like shells of a car.
Yeah. Luckily they only take up a kitchen worth of space.
Right. But, but if the snow gets too high on him, it crushes the Isettas.
Oh,
so he's just constantly trying to go over there and make those things to freedom.
That's the thing. It's like, I mean, the first part about it for us, because we're not up there, right? You joke about getting lost. Like you're driving through, you're literally a rat in a maze looking for your house. And there's no visual cues to find it. Nothing looks similar. And then the second is, you know, the pain in the ass of all the snow and everything. But really, then you start to get into like the danger factor, not being able to get around, the fact that it's still snowing in Mammoth as it, like while we're speaking, it's breaking the all-time record. Yesterday it was 5 inches short. Today they've gotten those 5 inches. They're expecting another 20. And then you get into the danger, the structural damage, and the insurance companies are like, if you don't think your damage is X dollars, don't bother calling yet.
Yeah.
And it's like, but they're pretty sure everybody's got something.
You know, everyone's gonna call
it's like 50 tons on a small roof.
Yeah.
You know, it's really you have to feel for people in that live in that scenario. And I'm actually moving to Colorado this summer, and there the snow doesn't come down as big as we have seen in Tahoe and Mammoth and Big Bear, but it does add the anxiety. Added the anxiety a little bit, all the snow plowing and every day, you know, maintenance of that. But what an amazing season. I really hope that we capture some of the snow on the snow melt and fill the reservoirs.
So, you know, Goldberg's trying to join us as well. So, but he's traveling to LA or is about to travel to LA. He's trying to get it figured out. So maybe he'll jump on and say hi in a little bit. So just so you guys know, he's trying to make it work. But before we get into other stuff, I don't want to say the good stuff, because other stuff, I want to talk a little bit about flying, because that's the good stuff.
Sure.
You've been flying a lot for years now, and every time I see you, you're like, yeah, flew over here. Just flew over to Barrett Jackson, flew over myself. I think we did a while back, we might have done a track day up at Willow Springs. I don't know, maybe it was like Jeremy Fry was putting something together. He's another
Oh,
stuntman friend of ours. And you're like, no, I flew here and I took a fold up bike and put it in my plane and bike from the airport to the track, and then you're going to just bike back to the plane and fly home.
yeah. I when we finished Top Gear, I had wanted to get a pilot's license, and I didn't know what an obsession it would really be. I had a kick going throughout the years of shooting that show. I started that show really just loving the fun of driving. And then, as my daughter got through her teenage years, I started to get super attached to the whole idea of the human potential, like making sure that you took ownership of taking yourself from A to B instead of living in a screen. And when you watch a kid, how addicting it can be to live in a screen, and you are dragging them out of the house sometimes, and finally getting them to like going out and being outside. It's like, it's foreign to us because, not to say that you're old, but that we, didn't have necessarily that kind of, I guess, reason to stay inside. We always played outside.
Totally. Always play it outside. But also I did a lot of stuff on cars back in the day. Like, instead of, fussing around with my phone, which didn't exist, like we were kind of horse trading, like, oh, I got a nitrous kit. I'll trade it, for used pair of cylinder heads. And, if you come and help me install them. And, my brother and I, my friends, we were just constantly thrashing
Oh, totally. And the
on cars.
like the cause and effect of that. So like you would inject some negotiation, some effort in installing, and then the benefit was the hit when you hit the throttle, and that thrill was like nothing else, and you were ready for the next one, right after that. Yeah, so that and that's what I'm talking about. It's just you did that yourself. And I airplanes and general aviation is what it's called, GA. It's just this whole nother layer of freedom where you it, that exists. Maybe we're the last generation that can enjoy it, but you can just go fly. You don't have to talk to people if you don't want to. You can just go fly places. You can cut the grass in your lawn if you have enough land and make a runway. I mean, it's an amazing freedom that exists right now.
Bill, welcome. We were just talking about flying. Can you
Beautiful.
hear it? All right, you can hear us. All right.
Unfortunately, I got to get on a plane tomorrow.
You got to get on a
Yeah,
plane. I know you
perfect.
do.
Perfect.
Taylor's been flying his own plane around, and back in my teenage years, I was really into like Air Force, ROTC, Civil Air Patrol. I got into that stuff. So I started flying as a teenager, and then, eventually high school ended. You start moving across the country and you're going to school, and you kind of lose part of it and you can't afford it. But I can relate in that I went, I did it, I logged a bunch of hours. It was fun to do. I was in South Florida at the time. Flying out of Fort Lauderdale, flying like Fort Lauderdale to Palm Beach, and just and practicing just like touch and goes, and just doing some fun stuff. It's good. I don't know.
I'll chime in real quick. I got some absolutely horrible memories of flying, and I am the only Goldberg that doesn't have his pilot's license, but there is a reason for that because I'm 16 and 18 years younger than my two older brothers who would take me up when I was, I don't know, 4 and do touch and goes until I'd throw up.
That's
And
amazing.
segue to probably 15 years later when my brother, who's the largest independent contractor of cargo planes in the world right now, used to take up in his glider. And then he had a T-34 that he took me up and did hammerheads and freaking every aerobatic you can think of. And he knew how claustrophobic I was. And so I cannot chime in on the beauty of flying. For me, it's more memory.
It brings back a lot of nasty memories, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Throwing up repeatedly is not the most fun thing to do when you're. Yeah. So, needless to say, I'm not a fan of flying myself, but I can greatly appreciate its convenience.
I I got a chance to get up in a helicopter as well, which I thought was super interesting. I don't know if you guys have done that. You've been in a helicopter. Have you tried to fly? Have you been in, Tanner?
I've flown one. I flew Dave Sparks Heavy D. They've got way into it.
Okay.
And so he let me fly his a little bit, and it's a lot more touchy than I thought, you know, cause I work with helicopters all the time in filming.
Yeah.
And they just make it look so freaking easy.
Oh yeah.
And they, you know, Fred North is somebody I follow on Instagram, and he was one of the first movie helicopter pilots to post a bunch of stuff. And every single day he's putting up some amazing thing. And now that I've got a little sample of how difficult it is, man, I appreciate what those guys can do.
So, you know, you were telling your story about, like, you know, flying and, you know, taking your kids up and trying to get them out of the house and experience something that's not just in front of the TV. So, I don't know if you guys are friends with Lorenzo Lamas, the actor Lorenzo Lamas. He's a sweetheart of a guy, big supporter of military. He's a good driver. And we did some charity stuff together a number of times. Long ago, he his kids were young and he got divorced and she moved off to, I think, like Arizona or something. He lived in California, still working as an actor. And he's like, I'm going out there almost every weekend to see my kids and it's costing me a fortune. So he's like, I'm going to get a pilot's license. I'm going to start doing this myself. Right. And you're right. Like you said earlier, Tanner, just sort of controlling your schedule, your destiny, like just controlling all of that aspect of it. So he starts flying back and forth. And of course, you know, now the kids are older, they're in their 20s and they're adults. And as they got more like high school lives and a little less spend time with dad on every weekend, he switched from planes to helicopters. Mm-hmm. And we did a bunch of stuff together. And then he's like, you come up with a helicopter. Let's do a day. I'll teach you how to fly. And we went to Van Nuys Airport and fired up a helicopter and flew it around. Ooh. And he was so calm, so fantastic. And, within an hour, like you've got some basic control of the helicopter. Like you're trying to figure it out. Now you're right. It is just getting it to hover in place is more difficult than flying it. And you just feel like you're bobbing, like hanging on a string, like, and, you know. And it was so much fun to do. It's definitely worth trying. I know getting a helicopter license is more expensive or more complicated than.
I think it's pretty. It is a little. It's very similar. Like once you have one, you can easily get the other.
Yeah.
It's like there's so many weird little rules. Like with airplanes, it's like it's speed over the wings makes the lift. Don't go too slow. It's like there's something super basic about that. Plus, airplanes are really efficient over long distance where the helicopters aren't so much. But then you get in and they're like, okay, this particular helicopter, you can't nose down because the prop will hit the tail and break the tail off. And then we die. And you're like, what? And then, and then in this one, you'll make sure you never come to a stop before you like get close to the ground effect and all that, because then you'll get your own rudder wash. We'll flip over and we'll die. And I mean, it's like there's so many little rules for helicopters, the things you can't see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys touched on the convenience. I can empathize with that exponentially of using private aircraft. But, my brother, who has been a pilot ever since he was 16, is now a Ferrari guy. And he was involved with NetJet for a number of years before COVID. And then he got out of NetJet, but he was one of the only owner operators that would fly. So he'd fly the 10 and
Citation. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically for him, it was an extension of going. It was the next step, right? Of control and of fun. So Tanner, you've done just about everything in the frickin' world, right? So I can see how you would really enjoy the ability to go up by yourself in a plane or a helicopter and do your thing with it, man. You know, it's just another extension of our personalities.
I do. I agree. I do like the stick and rudder of it and the control factor, and there's no speed limit. There's, you know, the layer of freedom's amazing. I'm still in the phase where it's the time machine factor, where you can land in an airport right next to where you need to go. Like if we were doing this in person, I would just come up and I'd land in Burbank or Van Nuys or whatever's closest to you guys. And it would take 12 minutes to get there. And I wouldn't have to deal with all the traffic that's sitting in the rain right now in LA. And the, then I know the next layer is aerobatics and getting into that part of it, which I wouldn't mind getting into. I love those guys that are also kind of mountain adventurers in Idaho and, you know, the Trent Palmers of the world that are landing on mountaintops. You saw that video recently Red Bull just did where the guy landed on a helicopter pad on top
of skyscraper.
Yeah. And so the people are pushing the limits all the time, which is cool. Right now there's a show, kind of the SEMA of airplane world, is going on in Florida called Sun and Fun, which is the aftermarket parts world of airplanes. Then the big one is Oshkosh, of course, which I've never been to, which I want to go to this year.
But yeah, I could see you segue into those air races.
The air races look freaking crazy.
I mean, let's be honest, right? It's
kind of like I never got into sport bikes because I knew I'd like it and the danger factor is so up there.
Yeah.
So I almost don't want to sip on that nectar too much. but yeah, that looks awesome. I mean, they're in there like, and it's like old, it's so similar to hot rodding because they're like taping up the seams. It's all about aluminum craftsmanship and they're visualizing stuff. They don't have, you know, a 3D rendering of the plane and its aerodynamics and stuff working for them. They're literally like hot rodding these planes.
And like a race car, you're literally wearing the plane. I mean, the thing
yes.
has no size whatsoever. It's just a trick monster, you know?
Yeah, no, it's scary. I mean, because they obviously, when they do have a problem, you see when they make contact with the other planes.
Oh, yeah.
Like, their friend is altitude, and they're going like 500 miles an hour. So they just instantly shoot straight up to gain a bunch of altitude. There's the airport and then they make their way there. But it's still, I'm amazed it goes on still. There are a lot of fatalities, unfortunately, still, not to be Debbie Downer.
No, but they're nuts. They are absolutely nuts. And the attention to detail must be unbelievable because I couldn't imagine taking a hot rod up in the air.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of them are, like you said, they're modified. Some are home built. And, you know, of guys that like us that have had car projects, we've had our fair share of issues with those cars, just keeping them running and keeping them on the road. Like
they're on the ground.
Yeah. We're still on the ground. If you've got to keep it in the air and you've got the same sort of build quality issues and parts issues.
Right. And they're not running like new aluminum V10s or something, you know, they're running 1940s, 1950s technology, doubling the horsepower and, lessons learned the hard way of what, you know, is the weak link, fix those along the way to get that horsepower and hope it stays together.
It
sounds like the last 3 months of Dodge. Doubling the horsepower and trying to keep things together. And I would be remiss in not telling you that, guys, that the reason why I was late is because I finally got my 170 order in.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, you got the Demon 170.
Yeah, and I really want to bring this up because it is hugely contentious right now, and you guys know about it, but you're not fully solidified into the Dodge brand like I am. But can we please talk about what's going on with these dealers and the overcharges right now? And I've got some stories that'll blow your socks off.
I
just came from a dealer who is one of two dealers in the United States that doesn't charge a penny over on any of their specialty vehicles. They got 8 allotments and sold all 8 of them for MSRP. Conversely, my buddy Rob Hart, who spent millions of dollars with his local dealer in the past 4 years, mm-hmm. 7 out of 8 of their allotments have sold for $250,000 over.
What?
Yes.
Good Lord. Well, do you remember the Ferrari story, right? When the F50 mm-hmm. came out, or F40. No, it was the F40 came out. The dealers were marking them up like this, hundreds of thousands over the price, and Ferrari then mandated that all dealers had to sell the F50 at MSRP. And I think they went as far as to only allow leases or something like that. But the way that it works now, still at a Ferrari dealer, since you said your brother was into Ferraris, they will only sell at an MSRP, but they have such a limited supply that you almost have to agree to sell it back to them when you're ready to sell. And in some cases, they'll do a written contract with you that if you buy it for MSRP and sell it back to them within a year with under 3,000 miles or whatever, they'll buy it back for $10,000 or $15,000 more than you paid for it. And then you'll have your deposit in line for the next one that's coming out.
Well, yeah, and that's the caveat right there is if you screw up any way, shape, or form, you're not on that list.
You're blacklisted. Exactly. And right. So there's...
Or you got to fix it, right? Because I think Sammy Hagar did something. Like, he didn't buy some Ferrari to keep him on the list. And then at one point, he's like, I changed my mind. I do want a LaFerrari, because they're like, do you want one? He's like, nah. And then he went back and he's like, okay, I do. And they literally made him buy like a Ferrari FF as punishment. They're like, buy the FF and then you'll get the LaFerrari. And then you could sell the FF later. But they get the sale, and you know, like it, like, well, that's their punishment.
What a black eye on the dealer business, you know. I mean, you got two dealers in the United States that are charging MSRP, and you've got 99.999% of the guys who aren't. And what does that say about where we are right now? You know, I mean,
the problem. I've got guys.
There are people that are scrambling right now to get this car. And they thought that they'd automatically be on the list because of the tenure that they've had with their local dealers, and the amount of jailbreaks or amount of whatever that they bought. Mm-hmm. And they're all just getting boned, man. And
yeah.
I don't know what's – and you know, quite honestly, Dodge has come out and said, okay, well, you guys are at the end of the list. Your cars will be manufactured later, and the dealers that are charging just MSRP, theirs are the cars that are being built first. But if your number's matching your serial number, what difference does it make, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, right. So it's a catch-22. I mean, we all hear the rumors that a lot of people are leaving Dodge, but on the way out, man, they got to satiate the people who've really made the brand. I mean –
The problem with the dealer markups is they call it this market adjustment, and they're saying,
"Oh, bullshit!
It's not really a supply and demand issue. That's not how they're selling it. They're going, oh, listen, you know, the old Dodge Demon is worth you know, twice what it is now. So you're going to pay twice. Here's the thing: you don't get to pay on future value of something,
absolutely,
right? Like." Imagine if we sold houses that way. Imagine if we sold any car auction, collector car auction, you know, like you paid that day's market rate, and the dealers are going, no, 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 you're paying for what this car is going to be worth years from now, right now. And that's what is irritating, right? If it was worth $200,000, the Demon 170, then Dodge should have just made the MSRP $200,000, right? Right. If you went now and go, hey, like Tanner said, he's moving to Colorado. Imagine going and buying the house in Colorado and going, Colorado market's pretty hot. This house is going to be worth double in 10 years. So I'm charging you double now. And you got to pay double now because it's going to be worth that somewhere. Like that doesn't make sense. Then just hold on to it. Like it's kind of a weird space, but, I know we'll go down that rabbit hole of dealer markups for a long time.
Oh, well, yeah. Every single thing is being marked up at this point, it's not just one dealer. One brand. I mean, they're asking 75 over, 100 over for the Raptor R, right down the street. I got the first phone call. I laughed them right off the phone. But, you know, some people are willing to pay it. And I don't know. It's just a shame. It truly is, because the people who really made the brand and who have supported the brand so much over the past number of probably 10 years, they're all left out to dry. So
have you thought about getting a dealer?
As we speak, sir, 100%. Yes, we are. Now as
I what's going to happen is you're going to get sucked into the politics of the other dealers. So you're going to have to hold your own.
And I'm already dealing with that, you know. And I spoke to April Ann Sarah, but her husband this morning. And, you know, I thanked him exponentially from myself personally and from all the Dodge guys for doing what he's doing, because they've had specialty vehicles ever since they came out from Dodge, and they've never charged a penny over. And it's indicative of the dealership and their thought process and the fact that long-term is more important to them than the immediate gain, right? Because if you're charging me anything over, I'm never going back to your deal.
Right.
So I think relationships are much more important to the people who are going to be around forever. And this quick money grab thing is, you know, it's going to go away. But I think it's ruined a lot of dealerships. And yes, that may be one of the reasons why I'm searching for one right now.
All right. Let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk a little bit of John Wick. I went and saw it. Super fun. It's just 3 hours of action film, but action film like old school kung fu movie. Like, it's if there's CGI in that movie, and I'm sure there's some amount of CGI and stuff in that movie, what a wonderful job of blending it and making it seem as seamless as possible, not over the top like a Captain America where the entire movie shot on green screen. I know they went to some wonderful locations, but you got into this a little bit. Now, I know you've worked on a ton of movies, and the Bourne movies and the Fast Furious movies, and but tell us what you were doing on John Wick.
This was a weird one for me because I did very little driving. In the actual film, when you're watching the film, the actual car that you're seeing slide around, 99% of it's actually Keanu. And I've had a lot of actors say that they are doing their own driving and they're just not. But so my job was to train Keanu. So it started about a year before we wrapped, just going to Willow Springs, a car supplier out here, Dennis McCarthy. He brought just a truckload of muscle cars. Mm-hmm. And we literally went down the row, and Keanu and I both were like, wow, we like that one. And it just happened to be a CUDA, a 71 CUDA. And that's what we ended up using for the film. And so we did some training, came up with about six things. And Keanu already had skills from motorcycle riding, from other driving he'd done in other movies. But we came up with like six moves: reverse 180s, forward 180s, drifting while, you know, holding a gun. You know, six things that we could learn to do well enough to do in a crowd. And then they wrote the script, the action sequence, based on those six things, so he could do all of it.
That's
and awesome. Yeah, it was spectacular. And we shot it. Then it was 4 months in Germany. So some time went by. They hadn't even written the script for the movie yet at that point. Got the green light from Lionsgate, and then got the location and everything. We were in Berlin. And out there, we set up a sequence on the airport. I think it's the old Tegel Airport in Berlin. And that was the Arc de Triomphe area. And so we had it kind of coned off, and we couldn't use the actual Arc de Triomphe. I think it had some mural over it for like a couple months or something, and they didn't want to paint around that. So we actually shot it in Tegel. And so the CGI that you see are a lot of the traffic and
the other cars. Yeah, that's what I saw. There was just too many of the stuntmen and the actors standing in the middle of traffic with cars going by. I was like, no, that's way too dangerous. There's no way they're going to do that. It's too choreographed.
There were some, and then the effects department's so amazing how they, as long as they had a couple cars, then they could populate it with other ones that were very realistic, the same motion, lighting, all that stuff.
So I read something recently, briefly, that said, I think you were, the interview was with the director, the film, Chad, right? Chad.
Yeah.
And he basically was saying there was the scene with Keanu with the muscle car, and he, I think he credited you and said you went up to him. I don't know. You can clarify, but he basically, obviously he's doing an interview and he wants to make it interesting. He was like, we hired Tanner. He's great. He's a race car driver. He saw that the car didn't have doors on it. So Tanner came to me and said, since the car doesn't have doors on it, they were busted off. We should have Keanu pick up a gun from the street while driving, drifting the car. And then he said, so you would go out and see if you can do it. Then if you can do it, then you'll come back and teach Keanu to do it.
Yeah,
is that,
totally.
Is that kind of how it went down?
Yeah, it was Scott Rogers who was the stunt coordinator. But Chad is, they all come from stunts. This whole movie started just from stunt guys.
Yeah.
We probably got to know Keanu from doing Matrix. And we're like, what if we just did our own movie? And then the stunt guy will direct it, and it will be like the most badass thing ever. And it has proven to be like that. But it was super open format. I've never done anything like that where, you know, the creative was like, you know, what do you think? What do you think we should do? We got, you know.
At the end of the day, you know, when they ask the expert his opinion and to give his advice on it, and that goes well, and that's what they stick with, that's the best result you could ever get.
Oh, it was awesome. And they wanted to see that it was Keanu, right? So you had, so in the story, the doors get ripped off, the windshield gets blown out. So now, and it's at night. So now you can see his feet working the pedals. You can see him steering the wheel. So there's no doubt, right, that it's him. And then they had one scene where, you know, he's got to lean out the door and hold the steering wheel while they're shooting through the front windshield. And the whole thing that I've learned with the Wick story is that anything's a weapon, whether it's a horse or a car or picks up a pencil, everything's a way to kill somebody. And so he basically drifts this car into somebody. And I don't know, it was just something that I wanted to try, was to reach down and grab a gun that kind of appeared from under the car while you're drifting. And so we put some white tape down, put some cones to get the car sideways at the exact right time. And then you just had to put your hands. We propped the gun up just a little bit. You just had to find the white line and put your hands on the white line, even while you're sliding, just sort of keep it on the white line. And eventually the gun would hit your hand. And then, you know, I put the suit on the day. Chad, you know, we sent him a little phone video of it and he loved it. On the day I put the suit on, did it once just so it was in the can. And then Keanu's there. And, you know, he'd practiced it a lot. And, you know, now you're on a street with cars everywhere and people everywhere. It's a little different than out in an airport. And he freaking nailed it the first time. They did it twice just to have it. And I mean, he just reached down and scooped the thing up and gacked a couple more people. And it was like, in the movie, it wasn't super featured. It wasn't a super featured move. It sort of just kind of happened in the flow of it. But still, it's one of the rare times I've been able to sort of inject, have an idea, sort of a vision of it. And then you have these 200 people on set, like trying to make your idea work on camera. So it was a cool feeling. I didn't think I'd really get that much of a reward out of not driving as I did in Wick. It was really fun to be a little more on the creative side than usual.
And it's rare, but it's cool that the director saw the expertise. Obviously they hire you for a reason. So why not ask your opinion about certain moves? I mean,
Chad and Scott that were awesome. And with that, it is, like you said, it is rare. And Keanu was open for whatever. And he'd be fighting 5 nights a week. And then I'd get him on the weekends. And so we'd meet like during the day. So that would mess up his whole time schedule for going back to nights, you know, and he'd just come with bloody knuckles because he'd been using nunchucks, which are constantly bouncing back on him, and dogs ripping skin off, you know, because it's just inevitability of working with, you know, aggressive dogs. But it's a hard movie. There, I don't know how many stunt people, there must've been 70 stunt people involved in it. I mean, something crazy. And as they go, interestingly, they all show up with long hair. And once they get killed off, they get a haircut. Then they get killed off again, another haircut. By the end, everybody's almost bald, but you know,
so just you keep using them throughout. If you film it in order, I guess that everyone would start off with long hair at the beginning of the movie, and then everyone would have really short hair at the end of the movie. But I don't think it gets shot that way. But I mean,
it's a cool process.
It was a fun movie. It looked fantastic. And hearing about it, you're right. Like the scene where, you know, you're picking up the gun from the car, it's 2 seconds in the film.
Yeah.
But now you know, when you go, hey, why does it cost $100 million to make a film? Because 2 seconds took so much time, so much prep, so much training. And this entire movie is just like so much practice and so much choreography in every single little fight scene that it just came out wonderful.
It's hard to describe, but like I've got probably 50 to 100 videos in my phone of just piecing together that one gun grab, then a bunch of other ones, you know, all the 270 where he slides up to camera, all the 180s, the sliding into the Arc de Triomphe, all the cars whizzing by, and the donuts reloading while doing a donut was something we practiced a lot. It all took an enormous amount of time. And I love that they just wanted to do it for real. Because for me, okay, when I'm watching the movie, I'm like, oh, here comes a car scene. And then the action goes. And for me, it's like a car movie, right? For the gun guys, it's a gun movie. Everything has to be right. They're counting the number of shots as they're watching the film, right? And how the reload's working. It's like, oh, that's not how, you know. And then for the horse people, it's a horse movie. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, what kind of that's the wrong kind of saddle for that sort of, you know, for everybody in their different discipline, they're focused on the authenticity of that. And in the making of it, they had people at a high level in each discipline making sure that it was on point. And
well, you got to do that because there are weekend warriors that are on the internet just waiting to see somebody screw up a stunt scene, a gun scene, whatever it may be.
That's totally.
That's their life, right? So you can't get them any ammo.
Right.
It's interesting. Now, I wouldn't say Tom Cruise is the first to do this, but he's championed it more and more, especially over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years of having actors do a lot of this stuff, get trained to do some of this stuff, because it gives the director more ability to film it. And, one particular movie was Jack Reacher. And I don't know, you might have even worked on Jack Reacher, but
I didn't. A lot of the same guys that were on Wick did, though.
And they had Tom Cruise do a lot of the driving scenes when he was flying through, you know, through town in the muscle car and stuff again. And the sole purpose of that was like, well, Cruise wanted to do it. So the director was like, if Cruise is going to do it, we need to film it like we've never filmed it before, right? Instead of putting a wig on Tanner. Instead of putting a wig on Tanner to like, now we could show the actor. So the way they film that, especially a lot through the rear view camera, through the rear view mirror, they have a camera going, and then in the rear view mirror, you see Tom Cruise's face. So it's not like the camera's always on him. It felt kind of interesting, kind of natural. It was shot really well. And you can only do that with training the actor to make those moves. So,
I think there's no doubt that he broke those barriers. Yeah.
Yeah. Cruise. And now he's basically turned into Jackie Chan. He's flying off mountains. Yeah. It's like, I don't know when Tom Cruise became Jackie Chan, but that's what's happening with Cruise. Keanu, we've done stuff with before, you know, the Toyota, the Long Beach Grand Prix. Keanu's been out there. Adam and I were at Goodwood, and we filmed some stuff with him and did some interviews. He was out there with the Arch Motorcycles, his motorcycle company, and a cool guy. Only got nice things to say about him. When we filmed stuff, he was so fantastic. The way he just walked up and he was like, hey, you know. And I was like, hey, this is Nate. He's filming it for us. And he's like, hey, Nate, I'm Keanu. Do you mind if I just make a couple little adjustments? He's like, move the camera, move the light, went over there, took 2 seconds. And then Keanu was standing on my right and Adam Carolla was standing on my left. And then Keanu's friend was over there. And so Keanu's like, where am I going to be? And he came over and we showed him where he was going to stand. And he's so much taller than I am. So he adjusts the camera to be waist high, right? That's all you film. And then he comes over, stands next to me, but like spreads his legs like 4 feet apart. So he's shorter now and he's more on sort of that's eye funny. To eye with me, but it's still obviously
rare
taller
to get an actor to get to shorten himself.
Yeah.
Right.
And he just came over and it took 3 minutes and nailed it and it was fun. And then, you know, we sat down, we had lunch and the whole thing, but he was just sweet guy, time on the job. I'm sure you got to have quite a number of conversations. Like you said, if you're training with him.
Yeah, no, we spent months just at the premiere the other night. I mean, he was bringing up conversations we'd had a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
About a house that I was going through and Big Bear selling and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, he will remember so much more about the conversation you had it good with than you would ever believe. He's really an attentive listening friendly guy, you know, and that's he's got a reputation, he deserves every bit of it, and that's you know, it's great to see, because
that's what his fan base really has to know. I mean, quite honestly, there are actors in Hollywood, as we all know, whether it be stunt people or whether it be, you know, open card actors, but, you know, aren't personally how they portray themselves to the public. And it's wonderful to see a guy with such success that is such a down-to-earth dude. That's a car guy and a gun guy and loves to fight. I mean, hey, that's a dude. That's a dude right there.
So I'm not a gun guy, but I would say maybe just as an action movie fan, he's got to be one of the best gun handlers out there, right? As an actor.
Oh, yeah. Grand tactical, man. You know,
I mean, he's just got to be one of the best. You know what?
Yeah, when we got in the car, the stunt coordinator's like, "Hey, you don't need to talk to Keanu at all about the gun. He's forgotten more about guns than you'll ever know in your life. So just, you know, leave it at that." And sure enough, I mean, everything's dialed on that. He's trained with so many people and for so many years you forget that if the actor is interested in it, that they're going to retain the training and probably brush up on it on their own. Like, I've taken Keanu out to Chuck Walla, a friend of mine has a 2-seat Porsche Cup car. We just went out and did a lap day. You know, it's not for filming or anything like that. It's for fun. And I think he actually rode in my little airplane out there, you know, walked by all the jets and got in my little tractor with wings and, you know, loved it. But it's, when they genuinely love doing it, I think they retain the skills, and you forget how much training these guys do when they do action sequences. On the Tom Cruise thing, he definitely has broken the mold. And I remember hearing a story that was told about him where he wanted to do this thing and he went to the safety guy, and the safety guy said, we probably can't, you know, do that. And he said, okay, so, well, I got another safety guy.
Yeah.
And then, and then, you know, he goes through it, and he's just been in that position where he could just write his own, you know, way through that kind of stuff, and made it okay for actors to actually do stunts instead of just say they're doing them. And then you get to your point about how do you shoot that. We shot this almost the whole drive sequence with a drone. So I drove all 4 months exercising the drone, because Keanu could do the same move over and over again, but the drone would never be the same twice, just because it's trying to keep up with the car going 60 miles an hour and stopping suddenly and all that. And so it was really just about training the drone, which made it super dynamic, but also meant that you could be eye level close through all this stuff, not necessarily looking out from afar from, you know, a camera on sticks or in a camera car or something.
Let me bring up something a little different. As an actor who has done his own stunts, one thing that I must tell you that comes into play is that it's a conundrum, right? Do you want to do the stunt on your own? And can you look yourself in the mirror and realize that that stunt guy didn't get paid that day for that stunt?
Yes, right.
Right. So as realistic as I've wanted to make things sometimes, I've foregone the opportunity because I know the stunt guy and I want him to get his clip, right?
100%. That is a part of it. And there's even, you know, getting into the movie stunt side of it for a racer was super controversial. I think Dukes of Hazzard was the first movie we did. Reese Millen brought me on for that. And it was always like, look, do the technical driving. But when they say, because they're never going to say, hey, we're going to do a crash. We want this other guy to do it. You're established as that guy. You're Bo Duke or whatever. So, you know, the stunt is offered to you. But when that's thrown up, just say, hey, if there's a stunt guy who got here banking on that adjustment for that hit, then have at it. And, you know, that's not necessarily what we want to do anyway. We want to do the technical stuff and make the car live. When it comes to jumping it through the pile of cars and catching it on fire, these guys know how to do that without getting hurt. And so let them do it. But yeah, you're right. There is a balance there. But I think if you work as a double for somebody like Tom Cruise or Keanu Reeves, you know that, you know, you're only going to go into the stuff. Yeah. It's likely going to break your body, but you know, everything else you're not going to get to work for.
I mean, yes. And Bill, to your point, I can see the actor wanting to do the stunt if it makes sense for the actor to do the stunt and they're filming it in a way that they're taking advantage of it. But if your point is to, you know, to be in a fight or throw somebody through a wall and you just want to do it because you think you can, if they're not filming it in a way that it matters, then you're right. Why not give it to the stunt person?
100%. But also realize that, you know, I've been a stunt guy, you know, for my entire life. And if I can do something better than the stunt guy and have them be able to stay one camera on me and not have to get intricate with the filming and cover stuff up, then it's a conundrum. Do I do it, or do I and take money away from this guy, or do I just let him do it? And, you know, I just wanted to throw it out there because it's something people might not understand.
You're right. And I can't speak for anybody, but I got the impression in this film that for Keanu, the whole reason for doing it wasn't necessarily an ego thing. It was like he wanted to do it to make the story more believable.
Oh, yeah.
So you never took somebody out of the moment where they're like, oh, that's definitely not him. You know, you don't want to give the audience that chance. And that's the impression I got. And so, yeah, if there was a scene where it was the car's driving out of the Arc de Triomphe from, you know, an aerial shot, and you can't, he would not want to, they wouldn't even ask him to drive that.
Yeah.
But, you know, because it's not the point.
There was a move that I think goes to credit to Jackie Chan. Jackie Chan brought in this regard, he brought in a little bit of comedy, but realism. Like, he'd be doing a fight scene, and if you know, his hand got smashed in a door, or if he punched somebody, and then after he'd be like shaking his hand, be like, whoa, that fucking hurts. You know, like a little bit of comedy, but like realistic, like, listen, if you got hit with a ladder, it would sting. Right.
Yeah.
In John Wick, Keanu's version of that is he's always fucking tired. Like, you see him and he's moving. And then there's like a break for a second where whoever he's fighting is like, I don't know, just standing there for a second going, John, are you still alive or whatever? And he's always like, yeah, you know, like, hey, I kind of like that aspect there. Yeah. It's like the whole movie, he's just fucking tired.
But it's real. It's realistic.
So real. And he working 5 nights a week, and then I'd get him on a Saturday. He'd drop something. He'd get down on one knee and pick it up and just like, just kind of look up and then stand back up again. I'd be like, holy shit, freaking John Wick.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, he's just freaking tired.
He's just tired.
And at the end of the day, it's got to be – I mean, you've done millions of these things, man. It's just so much more fun to do it with guys who appreciate it, want it to be the best, and are not afraid to stick their nose in there and get dirty. You know?
Oh, yeah. It does make it way more fun. And they, you know, they come, they show up. They're like, I just want to learn to do what you can do. And they're, I mean, I wouldn't say students, but they're the best at learning.
But they are students because they care.
You know? Yeah, because they
enjoy
care.
It, and they enjoy it at the same time. You can't tell me Keanu doesn't enjoy driving. You can't tell me he doesn't enjoy shooting. You can't tell me he doesn't enjoy fighting. So at the end of the day, I mean, it's a better film, better production, better morale on set. And, you know, it's rewarding.
One thing I'll echo, the director's been doing some interviews, obviously, and I agree with him 100%. I think there should be more recognition for the stunt people in the industry. I get it. The entertainment industry is so fueled by ego. Imagine if every job we did, we rolled credits of people at the end of everything we did. It would be weird. Like, here's your hamburger today, brought to you by here's the chef, and here's this for here. Right. It's an ego driven thing in a sense. But if that's going to be the case, how come there aren't an Oscar category for stunt people? And I think there absolutely should be. And I think
100%.
I think this movie is a pretty good champion for that. And I think if you're going to go around and you're going to do the interviews and people are going to ask you this stuff anyway, then I think everyone who's out there doing interviews for this film should be pushing that, you know, Oscar category for stunt people, and not on the one that they don't air on TV. Just do it the right way. Just get them up there and give them some of the recognition.
Truthfully, they're the nuts and bolts of what we end up seeing at the theater.
Yeah,
they're the glue that holds everything together.
This whole movie, it's like this whole sequence, the whole John Wick movie, maybe from the beginning, the creative on it, it's like an homage to the stunt world. You know, it's I saw one of the actors joke that he was talking to Keanu, and Keanu said he hadn't said a word for like 5 weeks or something in filming, you know, so it's just stunts. But it's kind of like all these stunt guys, like, oh my God, I've always wanted to do this one thing and have this club with like water walls and you're fighting in the rain, and they do it. And then it's like, oh, I've always wanted to do this one thing where you have this gun that like blasts the fire, and then you get like every time you got shot, you got, you know, yanked out of the shot, and then they do it. And so it's sort of like they had these $200 million to just do this insane stunt reel. Right. Yeah.
And one guns, of those
horses, cars. Yeah. And it's directed by a stunt guy. Everybody involves stunt guys. And then they get this badass lighting and director photographer to make it super cool. And, you know, this kind of dark story that goes along, and it's like an homage to stunts. And so it's like, especially with a movie like this, how could you not have what it really is, you know, the core of the film, the stunts and the people that make that happen. How could you not have that recognized more?
The first movie I ever did was Universal Soldier, and Mick Rogers.
It was
the first movie Mick directed, and it was all stunt guys.
Yes.
I gotta tell you, I've done a lot since, but that was arguably the most fun I have ever had working in my entire life. I mean, it was from their mentality to their hard work to their perfectionist. I mean, it was unbelievable. And Mick Rogers is one hell of a dude, I can tell you that.
That's awesome. It makes great film too, because the stunt guys know where the action is. They know where it's going to explode through the lens, you know, where you're about to hit. And so it was even fun being able to talk about where a good spot for the camera to end up was. And on my phone, we filmed so much of the rehearsals. We'd have the car sliding at us, and you can feel as a driver, you know, where it's going to end up. Mm-hmm. So you could be right there in the face watching it land. But and then so the way they shoot it, even, and how they place the cameras as stunt people, I think is so much more relevant to the action.
That's cool.
How many cameras do you go through? How many phones do you go through? You run
over I didn't go through any phones. We did hit a couple drones, though. I think we buried a drone or two. I think a pilot or two cried, but it was I mean, you're at night, you're doing hardcore stuff. Cars are spinning around. There's traffic everywhere. It's inevitable some of that happens, but it was all in all. I mean, it was because we were shooting out in an airport. It was pretty spread out and open.
Yeah, that's cool.
I appreciate it. I appreciate your time. I want to get into just a couple of more things. I know you've got a lot on the table. First of all, you got more films? There's probably films in the can or stuff that's going to be coming up, because this stuff happens years before it comes out, right? You were working with John Wick, I don't know, a year or 2 years ago.
Something John Wick. That. The one that's not out yet is The Old Guard. Do you remember this, Charlize Theron? The Old Guard 2.
Okay.
That was kind of a drifting sequence out in Italy. I did with your buddy Samuel Hubinette, had him out. And we had a Viper involved, so we had to get Samuel in there from the old Viper drift days.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I
saw Samuel and his beautiful wife at the unveiling of the 170, man. I can't – I mean, you know them. They're just absolutely the most wonderful people ever.
Yeah, yeah, we have good times for sure. And so that was nice to cruise through Italy. We actually had like a bunch of test days on the car, but once the car works, the more you test it, the more you're just beating it up. And the mechanics are just like, you're getting, you know, they just want you to stop. So we got them working, and then we went to the Formula One race, where I've been racing for McLaren now for, this is the second year in an electric truck, but it was my first time going to an F1 race. So we went to Hungary to that round, and then we went and finished the filming. We had a great trip on that movie, but I'm interested to see how it turns out. I really liked the Old Guard, the first one.
Yeah, it was a good movie.
It was sneaky good. Like, I just sort of saw it pop in on Netflix and watched it. It was like, wow, that was really freaking entertaining. But so, yeah.
Tell us about what you're doing with McLaren, the racing you're doing, the electric truck. How did this
come about? So Extreme E is this series where it's 10 electric trucks that go around different parts of the world, 10 rounds. All the trucks travel on a ship together. And the interesting thing about it, the trucks are fast and the courses are gnarly and everything. And the drivers are gnarly. I mean, some of the top rally drivers in the world, rally cross drivers, off-road drivers. But the it's interestingly a series that has some sort of basis in sustainability. And what I get out of that is I'm a big fan of motorsport. I think in the last 100 years, we've all benefited from racing cars. Seatbelts, disc brakes, reliability, power, everything has come from innovations from racing. And there's a big risk right now that racing just ends from a manufacturer supported side, because they can just go spend $5 million on making videos and not racing and never lose, tell their story, yada, yada. There's a lot of benefits to just making YouTube videos rather than compete with other manufacturers. And it's scary times because the innovation curve is just flattening. And even the little bit of racing that I do with electric, I race Baja in electric car, do various other rallycross stuff in electric. Even just every single weekend, you're coming up with new things that would make it a little better, might be something for the next car build. So the innovation happens fast in motorsport. And Extreme E is doing motorsport in a way that has enough of the responsibility check. And, you know, people bring their, basically, it's like you bring your own cups and your own plates. You don't use plastic bottles. It's simple stuff like that, but it's enough of a check towards sustainability that it frees up all of the green sustainability money to spend it on motorsport, which I'm a big fan of. And I think series will probably need to start moving in this direction on a big scale in order to keep racing alive. And that's what I'm into.
It's interesting, because I was going to ask, why would McLaren get involved? But I see what you're saying. They're working on the future of their technology, right? There's a lot going on there in sustainability and stuff. So how does that translate eventually to, you know, to other cars?
Yeah. And it's, you know, the word sustainability and electric stuff doesn't always have to be anti hot rod and petrol head. You know, for me, it's a matter of the manufacturer money makes the motorsport world go around, and to keep them enticed in competition, sometimes there's going to be a hurdle or two that you've got to jump over, especially when you have these alternatives, like just making very inexpensive content. That's my thing. Right now it's dominated by companies that are involved in Formula One. They tend to have big companies involved, and those companies have a branch of sustainable money that they need to spend every year. And so this is a way for them to spend that budget with the same known team, marketing people or whatever that they spend their other racing budget with. So it makes sense right now, but I think, you know, it'll probably evolve into other things. But yeah, I'm a believer in what the big picture is. And for me, that is keeping racing a viable marketing option for the big sponsors of the world.
Yeah. Okay. And you're doing something new with Optima batteries as well.
Oh, yeah. So I'm not with Rockstar after 18 years.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, shifted to Optima batteries, which has been a cool thing. They are they do so much grabbing. Bill, you know, they do these shootouts. They have track events every other weekend around the country doing these amazing events from everything from autocross to Time Attack style track events. I mean, they really hit the grassroots world hard. their parent company, Clarios, is the biggest battery manufacturer in the world. Most of the batteries you probably have from other manufacturers, most of them are made by Clarios. But strangely, with electric cars, the 12-volt battery is even more important than in a regular car. Like in a combustion car, you can have a cell down in your 12-volt battery and it'll still start. It'll be a little slower than usual. If it doesn't work, you can jump start it. Like with an electric car, it just won't turn on if it senses any issue in a battery. So they have some cool technology that is coming out to address that. But so just sort of getting in front of that technology, I guess, with this relationship with Optima.
That's awesome.
Okay, yeah. No, it's good. Sounds exciting.
Yeah, it'll be cool.
It was a long time with Rockstar. Yeah, it was a long time with Rockstar.
18 years. They were great. They were great. You know, they sold to Pepsi not too long ago.
Right.
Like 2-3 years ago. You know, I think they had 6 employees when I started with them. And they had no idea about racing. Every time we talked to them about doing a program, you know, I would go do European racing, like when I was with Ford. And over there, they race like Ford Fiestas.
Yeah.
So Rockstar would be like, hey, so, okay, Rallycross sounds cool. The numbers look interesting and everything, but can you race like a Lamborghini or like a Ferrari or something? It's like, no, how about a Ford Fiesta? When I switched to Volkswagen, they're like, does that mean we're doing like a Porsche? I'd be like, no, it's going to be a Beetle.
Yeah.
I mean, they're coming out of their skin because they didn't see it as their brand, but it was all about X Games, all about a young, you know, demographic, and that all worked. But
yeah.
They were so willing. Yeah.
It's a Ford Fiesta, but it's a Ford Fiesta running 60 pounds of boost.
Right? Yeah, no, 60 in a couple seconds. Yeah, two seconds. But they, so, I mean, whatever. There's a long list of people. Like, I've been doing this for 25 years, and there's a long list of people that without each one, you know, any one of them, it wouldn't have worked or continued. And the people at Rockstar, you know, they were very trusting. They had sampled drifting, but that was it. And they were willing to walk through doors that they didn't have any idea what Rallycross was. They had no reason to sponsor a Fiesta or a Beetle or whatever. And they kept the ball rolling for me for, you know, almost 2 decades.
Well, I'm sure they learned a hell of a lot from you, and hats off to them for having the confidence in you to lead the way for them.
It was, I mean, you know how it is with sponsors. You there's no reason to get involved with one unless you feel like you can move the needle for them in a long-term relationship. And I always wondered, because I didn't ride dirt bikes much. I wasn't into a lot of their normal kind of scene, I thought. But I did get them access to manufacturers like Ford and Volkswagen, and got them as a small company involved in billion-dollar marketing budgets. And so that was sort of my use, was getting them exposure to a more mass market that wasn't their niche. And it took a while for both of us, for me and for them, to really realize how to utilize that. But I learned a lot from the relationship, because it is a brand that, you know, energy drinks are an interesting brand, because they, you know, it's a marketing brand competing with other marketing brands. It's a brand loyalty thing. You know, people go into a store and pick the energy drink based on some brand loyalty, not probably necessarily the flavor or the health benefits or whatever, you know?
Right.
So, it was a great run. And I'm so appreciative of it. And I've been compiling some, and it's nice that now my title sponsor Optima is not in the energy drink space. So I can still bring out some of that old content. And so we're compiling some of the fun stuff we've done over the last 18 years and put out some videos with that. But yeah, it's a rare opportunity that you get a sponsor for that long.
Well,
awesome, man. I think we're gonna wrap things up. Looking forward to what you're doing, what you got going on with Optima. You're still with Volkswagen?
Yeah, still with Volkswagen.
Yeah, good.
They didn't McLaren didn't consider them a competitor, which is good.
That's good. I mean, we laugh about it because it's Volkswagen, but Volkswagen Group does own many brands that would be competitive.
Right. Yeah, it's the McLaren deal is really about the Extreme E series, and for Volkswagen, I still have a spokesperson deal, even though we don't do rallycross with them anymore. I still do Nora 1000, an electric truck, and we're innovating on that and coming up with new ways to go faster and be more competitive. And then, with the Volkswagen R group, still doing a lot of things with that little machine. So, we have a Golf R that is for sale in the US. I think they're sold out, but they still sell those in the US, even though a lot of times our market is different than the rest of the world.
Yeah.
One nice thing about them is we're the one of the only places in the world you can buy a manual Golf R,
Yeah.
which is cool. Having a kid who drives manual who's 17 years old, I love that. But
Yeah.
yeah, it's pretty much just the US and Canada. But anyway, yeah. So still great relationship, still having fun, still enjoying driving and flying, and hopefully we'll get you up in an airplane soon. I know, Bill, you're not coming, but
So you're talking to Matt, not me.
Bill's out.
I'll
Bill's
do
out.
some wind walking. There won't be room for me Well,
All right,
Dan,
sir.
it was awesome to see you again, dude. No question about it. It's always a pleasure to have you on any form of what we're doing, man. So thank you very much. Congratulations. Continued success. We'll see you soon.
Cool. Thank you, Bill.
Guys, thanks so much for listening. You can find Tanner Faust on social media. You're going to see him all over the place in motorsports as usual. And chances are, if you're watching a movie, he's doing some driving back there. So keep an eye out for there as well. Drink Bravago, that's our website. Thanks for you guys getting the orders in and ordering our hard seltzers. And we've got more great stuff coming down the way. So check it
Go
out.
to Mo go to Motor Trend. I blew up a Dodge 2023 Red Eye on Faster with Finnegan last
Faster with Finnegan. I saw the clips from that. You and I talked about it a while ago. Just leaving a trail of carnage wherever you go.
God.
So check that out, Faster with Finnegan as well on Motor Trend streaming service. So until next time, thanks guys. Keep the air in the spare and the bag in the wheel.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.